The title of this conference by Father John Hardin is The Church as Custodian and Guide of the Faith. Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin has been a consultant to the consortium from its beginning and is closely associated with its interests as a communication enterprise for religious women in the United States. Father Hardin.
What we wish to look at this evening is on precisely how God has decided, first of all, to protect this revelation, then to provide for its periodic interpretation and explanation, and to give us a perennial guide for applying the truths of revelation, which are certainly unchanging, but to the changing circumstances of human culture, of our lives, and I might add, of our own moods. This guide, we believe, is the Church. And consequently, for this evening's meditation, I suggest that we reflect on the Church as divinely authorized custodian of God's revelation, and for us then, the guarantee of our faith. We first ask, why go into this subject? Why bring up the Church when we're supposed to be talking about faith? Well, we said, and we don't have to be told this, that there is a crisis of faith. But frankly, I think if we look at the matter more closely, we shall find that it is, at root, a crisis of faith regarding authority. After all, it is one thing to say that God, in the person of Jesus Christ, made a revelation of himself and his divine will. The trouble is that many others admit that too, and they are not Catholic. All Protestants say the same. You look up their New Testament, they've got the four Gospels, the letters of St. Paul, the Acts of the Apostles, and now with the Common Bible coming into vogue, for all practical purposes, borrowing a word here or a phrase there, same revelation. So what's the difference? These Protestants, using the same New Testament that we have at most two sacraments. Some, like the Quakers, have none. In fact, people who call themselves Christians, like, say, the Christian Scientists, deny that God ever became man, or the Unitarians, who call themselves such precisely because they claim they are not Trinitarians. They deny the Trinity. More still, again I am dropping pieces of scenery so that we'll appreciate a little better, I hope, with God's grace, how indispensable this Church is. Revelation is not enough. Someone must assure us that what God revealed in the first century of the Christian era is what we've got in the 20th century. And of the meaning that is being given to "this is my body, this is my blood" is either true or not. Or, and especially on the practical level, what do we do? How apply it? Consequently, and these are the last people you would think I would bring into this, the Muslims, 500 million of them, surely you would say, they don't believe in the New Testament. On the contrary, they do. They believe that the New Testament was God's revelation, honest. They are offended if we say they are non-Christians, as my Muslim friends have assured me. Yet, for them, Jesus Christ was only a great prophet. In fact, somewhat less than Mohammed, because, so they claim, Jesus, if you please, foretold Mohammed. During this day, when it is stylish to talk about Christian pluralism, you're going to hear a lot about that, Christian pluralism, which means that no single expression of the Christian faith is fully true, but all are only partially true and need to be lumped together to get at some semblance of what is really true. It is of crucial importance for us Catholics to know when to say yes and when to say no. In other words, we must know at the risk of having our faith evaporate into the morning air, we must know, what did God reveal? What does it mean? And how am I to use this revelation today? That's the yes part. And correspondingly, we must also know what God did not reveal, what His revelation does not mean, and how it is not to be used or practiced today. These three no's are as important as the first three yeses, and we can know them both only if we also believe another part of God's revelation, namely, that Christ established a church of which He is the invisible head. And because we are very palpable, empirical human beings, He left a visible head, His vicar, the Bishop of Rome. In other words, we cannot fail, provided we know when to say yes and when to say no regarding God's revelation. Without that, as Bellarmine, the name of the theologate where I teach, great doctor of the church and a fine Jesuit, by the end of the 16th century, he counted 250 interpretations of the words of institution at the Last Supper, "This is my body, this is my blood." Am I being clear? We may be most ready to believe, but Lord, what am I to believe? Who's right? Who's wrong? Why is it impossible that this church, which we believe Christ established, to protect, to interpret, and to apply to modern times, whenever they occur, good to recall, these modern times keep recurring. Why can this church not fail us? Because it has not failed those willing to believe for the last 19 centuries, which, we might repeat, is a better record than any organized society of history. The empires of Rome, of the Ottomans, of the Mongol dynasty of China, of the Habsburgs, the Bourbons, and the Tsars in Europe have all gone. And as history gets longer, their place in the history books gets shorter, because other dynasties have come and gone. And the present states will also disappear, including, we are sure, the communist empires in Russia and China. Yet, the Catholic Church remains. Again, why can this church not fail us in this all-important, and as you must gather, I am working towards a climax, which we will just begin to touch today. Why can this church not fail us? Because without the church, indefectibly and when needed, infallibly, deciding on what is and what is not true in doctrine and morals, well, let's be honest, Christianity would by now have also become only an episode of past history. A group of odd individuals, let's see, what do they call themselves? Oh, yes, Christians. Strange people. Strange people. You know what they used to teach? One man, one woman until death. How impossible can you get? They used to say that, listen to this, that God became man and that he, honest, that he somehow lives inside of a little piece of bread. Well, as you would expect, they used to be. Had it not been for this church, therefore, over the centuries, preserving this revelation, explaining it in plain whatever people needed, French, German, or what is not English, American, the revelation that we now have, well, we would now know, could not have been a revelation. Why not? Because the same God who revealed, if he is God, would also, he wouldn't have been a smart organizer. He surely wouldn't have been divine if he had not provided for its perpetual endurance and infallible certitude. I have this marked in red in my notes, which means I should tell a story. Last fall, I was invited by the Bishop of Joliet, Illinois, to somehow put on, I guess you would call it, a day's program on papal infallibility. You know why? Because last year was the centennial of the First Vatican Council. There are bishops who still want to promote the papal infallibility. This is one. In responding to the invitation of the bishop, I suggested, would you mind having one of my doctoral candidates from Canada join me in the program? Well, who is he? He's an Episcopalian. Well, to reassure the bishop, I said, Bishop, have no fears. He is all for the papacy. In fact, that's his doctoral dissertation. He won't even pass unless he supports the primacy. He believes in it. So the two of us showed up before a gymnasium full of people, which was kind of nice. Priests, sisters, and laity. Well, I gave my speech, which was, I suppose, run-of-the-mill. Then he talked. Get the picture. Here's an Episcopalian who is talking on papal infallibility. He believes in it. Well, he figured, he told me, Father, he said, I think you ought to give the theology, which I did. I'm going to talk from experience. He had the audience spellbound. For 1 hour, this man told about his experiences as a pastor. Married people, recently divorced, would come to him, real bright, with their next prospective partner. When could he solemnize their second or maybe third marriage? Being an honest man who takes Christ's words literally, he said, sorry, I cannot solemnize your marriage. Why not? Because I believe that marriage between Christians is for life. They stammered. But we know that in this diocese, why, any Episcopalian parish would solemnize our marriage. How come you won't? Sorry, I can't. So they call in the bishop. I'm now quoting my friend. Who calls me? What's this I hear? You don't want to solemnize a second or third marriage? That's right, bishop. Don't you know the rules of the diocese? That is permissible? Sorry, bishop. I don't believe in it. Well, so he told the people, you Catholics don't realize what a gift of God you have in your church that knows when to say yes and when to say no. I should add, pray for him. He wants to become a Catholic. This Episcopalian pastor, married, has 3 lovely children. He got his doctorate, incidentally. But he would like to remain with his family. Rome has given approval. So far, the bishops have not. so far, why it is important that there be a church which will tell us what is revealed, that when Christ said in the 19th chapter of Matthew, "He that puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery," period. Why it is important, not only in general, but now for us in the religious life. Part two of my homily. All of this that we have said should be reflected on and prayed over earnestly. And mark my words, sisters, in the years to come, it is faith in this indefectible church that will preserve those who are Catholic now into the years to come, and for our purpose, those who are religious now to remain religious into the future. Especially when we read or hear, and every day, somebody says something new. Strange voices are being heard, saying strange things for our purpose about the religious life. As I like to say it, the Vatican Council, second that is, did not convene 1 month too soon, just in the nick of time. In all the centuries that the Church has been in existence, and as we are told from apostolic times already, in the 21 general councils, some of whose proceedings and declarations fill volumes, yet, good to hear this, do you know that out of all these thousands of pages of conciliar documentation on, you name the aspect of Christianity which had over the centuries been questioned or denied, Christ's divinity by the Arians, the necessity of grace by the Pelagians, the authority of the Roman primacy by the Hussites and the Protestants, the ability of the human mind to come to any knowledge of God by the rationalists. In each crisis in the Church, a council met to meet that crisis. Yet out of all this welter of documentation, there has been nothing, in fact, and of all the 20 previous councils, this is part of my business, so I'm talking shop. All the 20 previous councils put together did not say one-tenth as much about the religious life, speaking as solemnly as the councils of the Church always speak, as the Second Vatican Council has, on this single subject. Never in the history of the Catholic Church has there been a whole solemn document uniquely on the religious life. It is not coincidental, therefore, that there should have been founded a consortium Perfecti Caritatis. There never was a Perfecti Caritatis before. There couldn't have been such a consortium. Now why? Because in ways that we are sure, good Pope John, who saw no evil, thought no evil, felt no evil, couldn't possibly have suspected. He just wasn't the type. Yet when he convoked that council, we know the Holy Spirit was convoking it through him. The Spirit of God knew, and we're not getting down to religious life. I'm building up a case for the next 5 days. This Holy Spirit knew that whatever were the heresies, and that's the word to use, in fact, it's kind of mild these days. Some people almost enjoy being called heretics. Well, thanks. It shows a bright, creative mind. The Holy Spirit knew that among the falsehoods dealing with God's revelation, that the people of God must have it straight, is what is religious life? How was it revealed? And how it's to be lived today. There are two main documents of this council pertaining to the religious life. May I suggest, as part of your retreat spiritual reading, that you read both, in one case, two chapters of a document, in the other case, the whole document. Chapters 5 and 6 of Lumen Gentium, which, as you know, is the constitution of the Church. And the not-so-long document, Perfecti Caritatis. Out of several thousand words, and accumulatively it amounts to that, there is one statement that deserves to be memorized. It occurs in Lumen Gentium. Is paraphrased in Perfecti Caritatis and is repeated verbatim by Pope Paul in his June 29th apostolic exhortation to religious, which, except that we are now in retreat, I would be translating, and or willing will finish. 58 pages of Latin is a lot of Latin by the time of the meeting in Washington. Let me quote this most important passage of the Vatican Council for our purpose here on the religious life. It comes in two parts with dots in between. The Evangelical Councils are a divine gift which the Church has received from her Lord, and which she ever preserves with the help of His grace. Part 1. Part 2. Consequently, the authority of the Church under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit has the duty to interpret these evangelical councils, to regulate their practice, and finally to build on them stable forms of life, unquote, the council.
This conference is continued on Side B.